So from now on, we have to be careful what we say.
Well, from now on, Ken's going to hear it.
He listens.
He's the only one. So.
I do.
You listen to it?
Yeah, I listen to both of them.
Oh, wow.
From beginning to end. Nobody else?
Sorry, that's two.
Sorry, I missed this.
And I heard them.
Listens to these recordings. He sends out an audio of the meeting.
I haven't been in
this. Send the link.
You've got a problem.
Send this in?
It's Gary and Liette. Hola.
Yeah.
Welcome. You haven't been here before.
Gary, how are you doing? Are you going to sit down there? Or do you want me to sit next to you?
Well,
no,
I'm south here.
And
are you feeling lonely?
I'm here. I'm here. And I've got the latest audio-visual apparatus. You won't see down there, so...
I think we're probably at 4 o'clock now.
This is just easier for me to...
Okay, we've hit 4 o'clock. Chad wants me to be a little more formal than I've been, so I'm going to call the meeting to order this time.
And that's the end of that, right?
And that's the end of that. That's the end of the formality until we call it off at the end.
Exactly.
This is Philip. Philip Rylett is going to be presenting the subject of free will to us. And if there are no other issues, we do introductions from time to time, but would you like...
Well, I understand that.
Hmm?
I understand that if you interrupt him.
Okay. Go ahead, Phil. You're on.
Just a second. I have a couple of words. I look back, and a couple of years ago, we had a debate on free will.
Yes.
And there's 4 of us, maybe, that were at that debate. And it was between Rich and Phil. Rich isn't here yet. I haven't seen him for a while. But Ron Berry summarized... back up a little bit more. We had like 75 email responses. This email response about free will went on and on and on. Eventually, I asked Ron Berry to summarize all the email responses and just put it in one document, which he did. And it's not available on our.
I have it on my computer, and I forwarded it to Philip, but I no longer know whether anybody gets anything in this group that I sent out. Did you get that from me?
I think I did.
Good.
I got a lot of...
Could I ask everybody when I send an email that I get some kind of response so I know whether it got to you? Because I never know. Okay.
Well, Phil won the debate, but as you probably know if you keep up on these kind of things... the debate is not over. it is still ongoing. Now it's between...
Well, we'll settle it today, right?
Between Sam Harris and...
Bennett?
Yeah.
Harris and who?
Sam Bennett.
Yeah, Daniel Dennett. And they have a good podcast on that I listened to the other day. So I just wanted to give a little back.
Okay, thanks. I say this is... Yeah, we had that debate. Still have to shout for the people at the bottom. We had this debate, and I think it was really the first time that I had ever given the talk, and I was, my ideas were rather unformed at the time. So, having given it a couple of times and being challenged on it, and I expect to be challenged on it today too, and that's fine. That my thinking has been shaped a little bit by groups like this. Just in time.
Hi.
So.
Is Gary
here? Yeah. Free will. So I'm glad you all decided to come here today, and you did decide to come here today. The issue of free will appears to some degree. The issue of free will appears to some, namely Fred, to mean we don't make decisions. And that somehow this position advocates fatalism. And that we are robots, we're just automatons, just being bounced around. But really, our daily lives are nothing but decisions. Our actions stem from decisions. And, you know, why are decisions and the nature of choice, why is it so controversial? Well, it turns out that we have a moral investment in our decisions. We are expected to have personal accountability for our decisions. We judge people's moral backbone by the decisions they make, all under the belief that, in the end, we are personally responsible for consciously making those decisions and deserve the consequences of them. So I'd like for us today to deconstruct a decision and see what it is and where it comes from. My view, and the central view of this presentation, is that there is no mechanism that can explain free will, that our feeling can easily be argued away, and therefore the whole notion of free will is unnecessary to explain human behavior. To do this, we are going to accept that we feel we have free will. Usually this is not a problem. Recognizing this as a feeling is the problem. Feelings, no matter how strong, are objectively unreliable and will never trump science's dispassionate objectivity. We also have to recognize that our language uses this subjective feeling to describe our situation. Words like decide, choice, responsibility, I, they all conspire to create a paradigm of conscious choice that is so entrenched in our thinking that it is almost impossible to escape. Even though we continue to use the words sunrise and sunset, we, well, most of the world and some Americans, that is, recognize this as a trick of perception, and we know the real situation with the earth and the sun. Okay, the popular notion of free will rests on two assumptions. The idea that once you make a decision, going back to that point in time, you could have made a different decision. We are free to behave differently than in the past. You choose chocolate, you could have chosen vanilla. It seems that this is the reality we occupy. Imagine two parallel universes that have behaved exactly the same up to the point where you choose between chocolate and vanilla. You decide on vanilla. You make your choice and carry on. No doubt your brain was in a certain state when you made that decision. Returning to that point in time, your brain would be in the same state. Now, given the same state of the brain, could you, in your parallel universe, choose chocolate? Both brain states would be identical. This would surely have to imply that there is something other than the brain involved in making the choice. Which leads us to the second assumption. Your conscious mind is the source of your thoughts and actions. The conscious desire to do something is the cause of the action. You feel that you want to move, then you move. You feel you consciously deliberate, and then you decide. You felt like vanilla, and you chose vanilla. I hope to show that both these assumptions cannot be true. And we will explore the relationship between the mind and the brain, and revisit an old question. Is your conscious mind separate from your brain? Now, before we speculate on that, we're just going to take a look at the brain and how it works. Not just at the macro level, where we talk about areas of brain like the cortex or the amygdala or whatever, but deeper into the molecular mechanism of how it functions. The brain is a mushy grey organ sitting inside our skulls. It weighs about 3 pounds. It's comprised of billions of nerves called neurons, and trillions of connections between those neurons. These neurons are always active. The rate of neuron growth in early pregnancy in the fetus, 250,000 neurons per minute. The first electrical activity can be detected at 12 weeks, but it just appears as random sporadic firing. At 25 weeks, a brainwave pattern emerges, and this remains until our ultimate demise. Now, neurons don't fire randomly, only in response to receiving some activity from other neurons. Neurons cannot fire spontaneously. Their function is very simple. facilitate transmission of signals from one neuron to the next. Altogether, they comprise carefully synchronized circuits that result in thoughts, decisions, and purposeful activity. Now, neurons, and I got my latest, look at this, latest in audiovisual technology. Ignore that bit there. The part at the top here, this is a neuron. And it's a very stylized representation of a neuron. There are some with the, you know, there are different types. But basically, this is the neuron and its parts. Now, like all animal cells, it has a body, and called a soma, where the DNA carrying nucleus sits, providing directions for the cell to make various proteins, etc. In a neuron, however, this is just the beginning of the cell structure. On the one end, the soma sprouts branch-like dendrites. Dendrite for receiving signals, while a long axon stretches away in the other direction. This can be up to a meter long. And that branches out into multiple axon terminals for sending signals. These axon terminals that we see here are very close to the dendrites of another neuron, forming a connection known as a synapse. We'll go into that a little later. There is a gap, the synaptic gap. Any given neuron will have about 1,000 synapses with neighboring neurons, connecting the cells and allowing them to send messages from neuron to neuron. But the cells must send chemical signals across this gap to propagate the signal. Within each axon terminal are sacs known as vesicles. This is this part here. It's the end of an axon. That's the part of the dendrite. And these vesicles, these little areas of cell, like a little bubble in the end of the axon, filled with one of 50 different chemicals called neurotransmitters. And each this won't last for long. This is fundamental to understand where my argument's coming from. Each neurotransmitter sends a different type of message to the next neuron, which recognizes the neurotransmitters with specialized receptors on the dendrites. And these receptor sites are like locks. And the neurotransmitters like the keys. Once these keys have been opened on the lock, the neurotransmitter drifts back into the cell, or either to be destroyed by enzymes or to be reused in vesicles. Now, back inside the cell, the neurotransmitters are again... when the neurotransmitters fill the receptors of the receiving neurons' dendrites, they can either be excitatory, encouraging the receiver to pass the signal on, or inhibitory, preventing the receiver from continuing the message. Any individual neurons' dendrites may receive neurotransmitter signals from one of many other neurons, and if the excitatory signal is stronger than the inhibitory signal, the signal is passed on. It triggers the receiving neuron to fire. Now, although chemicals are required to send a message from neuron to neuron, it has to traverse the axon. And it does this through electricity. So how does a clearly non-metallic human cell manage to conduct an electrical signal? Well, this part here is... Where's my little pen here? Sorry. This part here is the part of the axon here. This is the inside, and this is the outside. And here represents the charge. Now, all cells have charges across their cell membrane. And this is how substances, chemicals, molecules, that means they move in and out of the cell. Now, the electrical charges inside the cell, when it receives this neurotransmitter, all of a sudden the cell, it gets very porous. These sodium ions that have been outside the axon suddenly flood in. The cell's membrane permeability has changed. And the potential reverses. It becomes more positively charged in the cell. The minute this happens, the cell tries to pump the sodium back out. But it's a little too late for the crest of that signal. That has already altered the permeability of the membrane, and the sodium is still flooding into the cell. So you get this generated signal of sodium coming out, changing the potential. So the sodium floods in, it changes the potential. Changing the potential causes the next bit to become porous, and the mechanisms in the cells for recovery. We have a resting stage where the neuron is not active. Inside is more negatively charged than the outside. Once it receives those chemical signals and the permeability changes, it then goes into an active phase, an action potential, sodium floods in. There's a repolarization. There's also potassium involved with this. I'm trying to keep it very simple. And then it goes back to the resting. So it's just an impulse that goes along based on these chemicals briefly changing the permeability of a cell membrane and then waiting for the next signal to come along. So once it gets to the end here, the membrane changes slightly, and instead of sodium flooding in, calcium comes flooding in. Right? This causes these vesicles, these are these little bubbles inside the cell. These are full of neurotransmitters, little chemicals that are needed to bridge this gap. This causes them to migrate to the end of the axon. Once it reaches there, it fuses with the cell wall and releases the neurotransmitters. The neurotransmitters latch onto the receptors, and those receptors cause a change in the cell membrane of the next neuron. It is a very, very simple process. It looks rather time consuming, but if this axon was the length of the football field, a fast action potential could traverse it in a second. So the next neuron after it gets this repeats the same process. Changes the permeability of the neuron and the whole process continues. Now the thing to understand here, these molecules that sit outside the cells, these molecules in here, these pumps that pump the neurotransmitters back here, everything, they do not have intention. Cell enzymes do not decide. Cell walls do not adjust their permeability based on the purpose of the signal. This is a predictable chemical reaction based on the basic laws of biological thermodynamics. There is no cellular intelligence deciding what to do. It cannot fire on its own. In fact, it would be chaotic to imagine these cells firing randomly on their own.
You're talking about a seizure.
And we're talking about epilepsy later on, about how, if it does happen, it's not very beneficial to the organism. All it can do is wait for the signal, and depending on whether it's excitatory or inhibitory, it'll pass it on or not. That's its sole destiny. There's no intelligence, no thought, no decision. Just a very simple rule, and the reliance of molecular cause and effect. It is the staggering number of neurons and the connections with their organization that makes tracking this pattern very difficult and makes it hard to reconcile with the simple cause and effect. For example, the transistor in a computer chip acts as a switch based on an input. It has a very, very simple structure. Arrays of these form logic gates, and logic gates are assembled into specific processing units. There may be 5 billion transistors per chip, and while paling in comparison to the neuron, its connections, the transistor serves as a great analogy as to how something so simple can, when aggregated in sufficient numbers, result in something pretty awesome. Now, we wouldn't attribute free will to a transistor, even the ones in the self-driving cars, thankfully. So returning to the brain, how would free will operate within this mechanism? How does will integrate with this process? No one claims that there is a separate... No one claims there is a separate system for the will. We don't really need it. A separate will system with its own physical laws. In order to affect this, the biochemistry of neurons would have to be perturbed by a spontaneous action caused by a conscious decision. Now, how could that happen? If you cannot manipulate the permeability of the cell wall of the neuron, you're not going to have much of an effect on propagating new signals. So what could initialize this activity? If it is not some extracorporeal ectoplasmic mind hovering over us and disturbing brain activity, then perhaps you believe it is within the brain, a part of the structure, a decision center, if you like. How would it generate new signals? Special neurons that react to what? A neuron can only wait. There's been no special structures found. The brain is monotonously regular, and all of it is made of very simple structures. There's just no room to introduce free will in this molecular design. Nor is there any need to try and force free will in there. Although the brain is plastic and can make new connections, it is always as a result of external activity. Habits, practicing the piano, etc. You cannot try and explain free will by the brain suddenly making new connections. No one has ever seriously suggested that that is the case. Decision making is not a biogenerative process. We don't create something to make a decision. The staggering complexity is the key that explains purposeful brain activity, but is also the impediment to understanding it. But we do not have to understand it in its entirety to recognize the stunning similarity of its constituents. There's no reason to support free will. It is completely unnecessary. With this molecular mechanism of action, we now have to reconcile the existence of mind and awareness. After all, conscious control is implicit in free will. Well, you know, this is not that easy. Mind is the ultimate in subjective experience, and trying to reduce it to simple biological and physical activities following natural laws is often criticized, often coined the hard problem. And the exact nature and mechanism of mind and how it relates to the brain is not fully understood. But we can observe some nature of the mind by just playing with the brain. Want to change your personality? Alcohol. Want to change your mood? Antidepressants. Anxiety level? Anxiolytics. Valium. Kindness and aggression? Oxytocin. Steroids. We can eliminate consciousness altogether with anesthetics. We can induce non-real perceptions with opioids. With psychedelics. Pleasure with opioids. And we can observe these changes. And we can feel these changes. We can probe into the brain and stimulate various areas. And we can watch and ask what happens. The idea of a conscious mind that is separate from the brain begins to disappear under scrutiny. No respectable neuroscientist believes in an extracorporeal entity, the mind floating over us, perhaps like Casper the Ghost. However, the mind obviously appears to exist, so where is it? Now, looking for the location of the mind might be a difficult task, but we can see it at work when we probe parts of the brain, or observe it when strokes destroy specific areas. Brain problems give us some insight into the relationship between the brain and mind. Epilepsy is a defect in an area of the brain that causes an unsynchronized flood of electrical activity across neurons. The cause of the epilepsy is a structural defect. These membranes at rest are a little too permeable. The sodium ions flood in, you start a cascade of unintended action potentials. Now, once the defect is removed or obliterated, the patient can expect to see a reduction in seizure activity. Now, besides anti-epilepsy medication, decide to tame the fire of this area. Some epileptics' brains are so damaged that the only remedy is surgery. Now, obviously, the aim of surgery is to remove the damaged area without harming the healthy brain. So the brain surgeon inserts probes into the brain, and the brain has no, he just anesthetizes the skull, the brain has no pain nerves, so he can't feel anything. And the brain surgeon inserts probes into the brain, stimulates the area as if it were a neuron firing, and then watches the reaction or activity to isolate the problematic area. Sometimes they'll ask the patient to count backwards from 10, sometimes they'll ask them to move their finger so. And the patient is not anesthetized, so they can respond to the questions. Now, depending on where the defect is, the neurons may be involved in all sorts of activity, muscle movement, emotions, etc. In the case, in this particular case, a young woman stimulated in a certain area caused her to smile. A stronger stimulus caused her to laugh. Not only that, but the stimulation also caused her to feel joy. Again, the greater the stimulus, the more intense the joy. The surgeon could provoke guffaws of laughter from her just by increasing the stimulus. Now, if that subjective sensation were not enough, the scientists asked her why she was smiling or laughing. Every time the woman had a reason. One of the nurse's hairstyles was amusing. The tone of the surgeon's voice was hilarious. Never did she not give a reason, even though the surgeon was the one creating her joy via the brain probes. Our consciousness was very insistent that it was the cause of the mirth. But of course it was just rationalizing away the feeling. It doesn't like to feel it's not in charge. Now one scientist, Itzhak Freud, in particular, was very intrigued by this and started to do his own research on subjective experience and brain activity. He was particularly interested in our rationale for making decisions. And through carefully designed experiments, he was able to show that even when the outcome of a subject's activity was manipulated by the scientist, if the subject thought that he was in control, the subject always claimed there was a rational decision behind his choice, and that he knew that the decision was his, even when it so obviously wasn't. Now, over the past decade, psychologists such as Daniel Wegner of Harvard University amassed experimental evidence for a number of conscious sensations that accompany any willful action. The two most important are intention and agency. Prior to voluntary behavior lies a conscious intention. When you decide to lift your hand, the intention is followed by planning of the detailed movement and the execution. Subjectively, you experience a sensation of agency. You feel that you, not the person next to you, initiated this action and saw it through. But if a friend were to take your hand and pull it above your head, you would feel your arm being dragged up. We would not feel any sense of being responsible for it. The important insight here is that the consciously experienced feelings of intention and agency are no different in principle from any other consciously experienced sensations, such as the salty taste of chicken soup or the red color of a Ferrari. Whether free will has some ontological reality or is entirely an illusion does not invalidate the observation that voluntary actions are usually accompanied by subjective, ephemeral feelings that are nonetheless as real as anything else to the person who experiences them. A study done at the Center for Cognitive Neuroscience in Bron, France, has shed light on the brain stimulation and feelings of volition. Here it was electrical stimulation of the posterior parietal cortex, gray matter involved in the transformation of visual information into motor commands. When these were stimulated, patients made comments such as, "It felt like I wanted to move my foot. Not sure how to explain. I had a desire to move my right hand. I had a desire to roll my tongue in my mouth." They had no idea where this desire came from, just they felt it. And they felt they were the ones initiating it. Now, in none of these cases did they actually carry out the movement, but the external stimulation caused an unambiguous conscious feeling of wanting to move. And this feeling arose within, without any prompting by the examiner, and not during sham stimulation. The take-home lesson is that the brain has specific cortical circuits that, when triggered, are associated with sensations that arise in the course of wanting to initiate and then carry out a voluntary action. Once these circuits are delimited and their molecular and synaptic signatures identified, they constitute the neuronal correlates of consciousness for intention and agency. Now, if these circuits are destroyed by a stroke or some other calamity, the patient might act without feeling that it is she who is willing the action. Now, if you've heard of alien hand syndrome, alien hand syndrome is a brain disorder in which a person experiences their limbs actingly seemingly on their own, without control over the actions. Professor of Neurology at the Mayo Clinic, William Cheshire, describes a case of alien hand syndrome. We recently reported the case of a woman who was startled at dinner when her left hand suddenly began to interfere with her efforts to eat. Each time she brought food to her mouth, her left hand reached up and struggled with her right hand, groped about her face, and even struck her in the cheek. It seemed that her left hand had acquired a mind of its own. This bizarre behavior was explained by an acute stroke in her right parietal lobe, visualized by MRI. The stroke damaged the connection between the part of the motor cortex that moved the left hand and the parietal cortex that perceived the left hand movements as her own. She had lost the sense of ownership of the hand's behavior. The apparent purposeful movements of the alien hand are goal directed, which distinguishes them from the involuntary spasms of simple reflexes. Some patients exhibit intermanual conflict, in which the movements of the left hand oppose the actions executed by the right hand, without necessarily performing the opposite action. For example, one patient put on clothes with the right hand, only to pull them off with the left hand. The hands of another patient struggled with each other as they competed to answer the telephone. Another patient tried to turn left while driving, at which point the other hand tried to turn the steering wheel to the right. While playing checkers, another patient's left hand made a move he did not want to make. He corrected the move with the right hand, and to his frustration, the left hand responded by repeating the false move. These uncontrolled behaviors can be quite distressing to the patient, and they are all caused by strokes or some sort of post-brain surgery conditions, all caused by a physical disturbance to the function of the brain. Clinicians have been quick to comment on the significance of this syndrome with the claim of free will. Daniel Wegener, for example, in arguing that all conscious will is an illusion, considers the alien hand syndrome to be an example of the undermining of the experience of volition. The gestures of the alien hand are, in his view, fatal to the idea of mental agency. The fact is, writes Wegener, we find it enormously seductive to think of ourselves as having minds, and so we're drawn into an intuitive appreciation of our own conscious will. The absence of awareness having willed the alien hand to act, such that the patient feels a remote spectator to the actions of the hand, which seems to have a mind of its own, leads psychiatrist Raj Prasad also to embrace a deterministic view of human nature. Since the brain is the seat of all our experiences, he argues, then there is a part of our nervous system which is responsible for our belief that we have free will over our behavior. The delusion that we are responsible for all our actions. Prasad concludes, is one of the prices we had to pay for conscious awareness of ourselves to evolve as a function of the brain. So we've looked for the mind and the self as the controlling entity. We've looked at the cellular structure and the biochemical processes. We find we can influence many aspects of the mind by introducing various chemicals into the mix. We can invoke joy, fear, paranoia, love, rage, etc. We can alter levels of anxiety and depression. We can invoke seemingly spiritual journeys where egos dissolve and oneness with everything we experience. The ego boundary that lets us distinguish I from other is biochemically erased. While these obviously influence decisions, there are medications that actually change behaviors that we would freely consider free will-based. A class of drugs called dopamine agonist, agonists, usually mainly to treat Parkinson's disease, has long been suspected of causing strange psychological side effects, such as compulsive gambling and sexual activity. In a meta-analysis published in JAMA Internal Medicine, this aims to settle the question and change the way doctors, patients, and regulators handle these drugs. The meta-analysis of events reported to the Food and Drug Administration over a 10-year period linked the drugs not only to excessive gambling and sexual behaviours, but also to shopping sprees, stealing, and binge eating. So we've also looked at the functional structure of the brain by directly stimulating certain areas. It is not difficult to reproduce by external stimulation feelings of will, of agency, of desire, of intention, even when we have no involvement in the action or behavior. Our brain will invent a story to explain its feelings, even when those feelings are externally induced with a long fine probe and a microcurrent. It is no stretch to believe that the same stimulation from internal events would produce the same story. Now, we looked at the functional nature of the brain through brain disease and trauma. Strokes, tumors, and trauma give us much insight into areas responsible for decision-making in the brain. Now, no self-respecting discourse on brain trauma would be complete without mentioning Phineas Gage, the unfortunate man who had a large rod of steel entered just below his cheek and exit at the top of his head. Now, he recovered. In fact, he never even lost consciousness. But it destroyed a large part of his frontal cortex. And friends and acquaintances could not recognize the behavior of once reserved Phineas, now a grumpy curmudgeon. Now, equally compelling is the story of Texas tower shooter Charles Whitman. Now, when he was 25, Whitman began to complain of headaches, a severe persistent pain that he later described as tremendous. He wrote increasingly troubled journal entries detailing his mental state. Quote, "Recently, I have been a victim of many unusual and irrational thoughts," unquote. He paid a visit to the campus mental health center, complained of violent impulses. Then one day in August 1966, Whitman climbed to the top of the University of Texas Tower with a sawed off shotgun and began shooting. His 96-minute reign of terror left 13 people dead on campus and injured over 30, and only ended when he was killed by an Austin policeman.
And he killed his wife before that.
That's right, yeah. Whitman's suicide note requested an autopsy to examine his brain because he was convinced it would show some visible physical disorder. And the autopsy did indeed reveal a pecan-sized tumor pressing on parts of the brain responsible for action and emotional control. Neurologic and psychiatric disorders, we all have them, right, also contribute to our understanding of how the brain works. What to us seems so stable, our sense of self, can easily be knocked off balance by some structural or biochemical event. The I that resides so confidently inside us somewhere can be shown to be as ephemeral as the soul. Multiple personality disorders certainly present a challenge for the locus of this I. Sufferers of split personality can manifest up to as many as 60 personalities. They have no control over when the personality will change or which one it might change to. Decisions made by one might be completely at odds with the decisions made by another. The memory of that decision may not exist. Its rationale quite mysterious. Can these multiple eyes be located? No. They are simply characterized and identified by the thoughts that particular identity has. Nothing less and certainly nothing more. So, we have seen how neurons work. How do we reconcile this with a new thought? So we all recognize that decisions really involve a new thought. We know we do not have a mechanism for starting a mental chain of events at the neuron level. This neuron didn't start this. It just passed it on. And it'll pass on to the next one in this eternal dance. So does aggregating the neurons and mapping them onto functional areas change this? Well, absolutely not. There is no evidence for any decision starting that did not take its generation from prior signals. Now, we love to consider ourselves the originator and possessor of thoughts. As we have seen, there is no mechanism for this. There's no evidence that there is a director in charge. Even the very statement sounds illogical, as this director making our decisions would need to have his or her own brain, complete with a director, etc. It's an infinite regress into darkness. It only takes a very slight shift to move our paradigm from we have thoughts to we are thoughts. Thoughts define us. What was your first thought? What was your last thought? But all the thoughts in between. Why do you think the way you do? Because you're smarter than everyone else? Well, no doubt. But your thoughts are the result of everything that has happened to you. The things you had no control over. Your parents, your genes, your race, your gender, your basic physical attributes, your place of birth, your historical time of birth. No control over any of this. And then your exposure to surroundings, your environment, religious influences, education, customs you were exposed to. It's not nature or nurture, it's both. Every action you have observed, every exposure to a new idea, every conversation, every reaction, all this is subconsciously collected and stored, and all of it influences your subsequent action and behavior. Personalities form. Exposure to others influences you, and you influence others. It's an incredibly intricate dance with untold partners lasting your whole lifetime. Everything you do is based on everything that has happened to you and how you are genetically coded. There's nothing else. Whether what has happened to you is via intention or good luck, good or evil, your experience is unique and your reaction is equally individual. So when you make a decision, a choice, just think about the vast amount of input that you have had in a lifetime. Billions of decisions, actions and reactions. You are what you think. You cannot escape it. Your decisions will be based on that totality of experience. Where else could your deliberation come from? Why would you even need a conscious self to act as an outside coach in the decision-making process? It's only there to protect a fragile agency, a sensitive idea of ourselves, an ego. Decisions are simply a reflection of who we are and our state at the time a decision is made. Why do you prefer vanilla ice cream over chocolate? Why do you like Chopin over Tchaikovsky? Why are some people Republicans?
That's a question.
That is a big question.
Yeah, pause for dramatic effect. And others Democrats. Why are some people lazy and others hardworking? Can we choose the opposite? Who had the free will to choose the opposite? It was once believed that homosexuality was a choice. Why would teenagers commit suicide over the anguish of being gay in a straight world? When it was illegal to be homosexual in the UK, why wouldn't a gay person just choose to be attracted to the opposite sex? It sounds ridiculous, and it is. Tomorrow, try being gay for a day. And by that I mean choose to be truly attracted to the same sex. Think it is possible? Decide tomorrow that you like a food that today you hate. Try choosing to support the opposite political party. That's a real challenge. And don't just pretend, but embrace the opposing point of view. You can't do it. You can do what you will, but you can never will what you will. Now, some people find this notion of not having free will to be depressing. They think it takes something away from life. And it does. This idea of a disconnected, egocentric existence. But once past that, this can be liberating as we can start to recognize our connection to each other and to our past. That we are part of a system where what we do matters. We can't really take credit for our talents, but it matters that we use them. We can't be blamed for our weaknesses, but it matters that you correct them. So pride and shame do not make a lot of sense in the final analysis. The notion is that your choices and decisions say a lot about you. Not just your mental state at the time of the decision, but you, your biases, your prejudices, your hates, your desires, your ambitions and your goals. These are things that define you, not a momentary glimpse of a mental state in the fleeting present moment. A belief in free will is akin to a religious belief, since neither complies with the laws of the physical world. One of the basic premises of biology and biochemistry is that biological systems are really no more than a bag of chemicals that obey chemical and physical laws. Generally, we have no problem with the bag of chemicals notion when it comes to bacteria, plants, similar entities. So why is it so difficult to say the same about humans and other higher level species when we're all governed by the same laws? It's our consciousness that makes us aware of our actions, giving us the sense that we control them as well. But even without this awareness, our brains still induce our bodies to act. And studies have indicated that consciousness is something that follows unconscious neural activity. Just because we are often aware of multiple paths to take, that doesn't mean we actually get to choose one of them based on our own free will. As the ancient Greeks asked, by what mechanism would we be choosing? The physical world is made of causes and effects. Nothing comes from nothing. But free will, by its very definition, has no physical cause. Some people think that we may discover a molecular mechanism responsible for free will. But such a discovery would require a new physical law that breaks the causal laws of nature. I often hear, well, what about quantum physics? Quantum physics isn't going to come to the rescue. As a stochastic element, it would remain beyond our conscious control. It would make no difference. To put it simply, free will just doesn't fit with how the physical world works. So free will as an illusion seems quite rational. So why is it so difficult to accept for many people? Now, there are several compelling reasons that people have for believing in free will. Not the least of which is that we have a constant awareness of making decisions that seem to be driven by our own volition. In addition, free will is a very useful concept when it comes to the justice system. We take responsibility for our criminal actions and accordingly are eligible for personal punishment, which is deemed to be necessary for protecting society. And religious institutions rely on it. How else could we judge morality without conscious intention? Free will is an illusion derived from consciousness. But consciousness has an evolutionary advantage of conferring the illusion of responsibility. As researchers deepen their understanding of the molecular basis of human behavior, it will become increasingly difficult to entertain the fallacy of free will. In the final analysis, there is nothing really free about free will. Ultimately, there are only neurons that obey the laws of physics and mathematics. It's fine if you say, "I decided." That's the language we use. But there's no God in the machine, no ghost in the machine. There are only simple little neurons doing their job, nothing more. Thank you.
Very good. Very good.
So let the onslaught begin.
Well, I have a couple of questions.
Sure.
I like the presentation, and I agree with just about everything. However, isn't it still you making the decision? Whether it's your brain, the synapses, the neurons, it is still you doing it. It's your past. It's all these factors coming to make that decision, but it's still you.
Well, if you comment on that, he didn't say, I think, that you made the decision. He said your conscious self made the decision.
It's still a semantic.
Your conscious self, I think you could very easily make a distinction between that and the totality of you.
And I'm your conscious free will and your subconscious, I'm kind of going together. It's still you.
Yeah. And are you, the same thing for me is, are you the owner of those thoughts? Do those thoughts define you? And I would argue the latter. Because I don't think there's an I to possess. I think the I is defined by the things we believe that we possess.
Well, that implies that you can't change. You're incapable of making changes.
Oh, no, not at all. Not at all. In what way? Well, in what way? I mean,
it's me deciding to change. I'm going to quit smoking. And I know that's because of all the stuff I've read in the past about cancer and everything. I know that I've come to this decision through my neurons and synapses.
Yeah.
But then I made the decision. Whether I made it...
A decision was made.
A few minutes ago. Or conscious free will right now is still, it's you making that decision.
Well, if you're looking for a locus of the some entity that is actually making a decision, and using all the inputs as resources for making that determination, for that deliberation, then if you work backwards, you know, where does that I reside? That I really is the totality of everything that you have heard about smoking. And what tipped you over the edge? What was the thing? At some point, there was some compelling reason to tip you over the edge.
You're in control of that decision or not. So all this input's coming in and your unconscious mind is working on it. And at some point it feeds back up. It is already decided, and it feeds back up to this awareness that you've decided. So free will to me implies control, that you can push
conscious control
or another, and you can't. It's like it's turning around in there and it's just doing what it's going to do. You know, and so that's why you might be able to quit smoking and the next person might not. If it was simply a matter of choosing, everybody could do it. But it's not. It's like everything that's come into your brain has to come together to make you able to do that.
But I still include all that stuff as me.
Sure. It is you, but to be free will is not whether it's you or not. It's
whether it's my subconscious, whether I control
it. It's whether you control it or not. And your unconscious is completely out of your control.
Well,
see, your conscious is completely operating on its own volition. That's my belief.
I've got to...
And then it feeds back up during
the time. You're on its own volition.
Okay,
yes.
I got a hand at the bottom now. Oh, you don't, yeah. All I can see are silhouettes, the lights behind you, so... I recognize your silhouette.
As you know, I heard your presentation at Open Circle, and what came to mind as this gentleman was talking, as you were talking, was that the mind seems to be only located in this conversation, in this part of the body, whereas modern science physiology says that we think throughout our body, and I'm very aware that I have often made decisions based upon my gut, literally, or just ongoing dissatisfaction somehow. So I'm saying that even, I remember once getting a massage and the masseur touched my fourth left toe. All of a sudden, these memories came back from childhood. The most pleasant time of my life, but it was also when I almost lost that toe. So what I'm saying is that we're not just thinking with this, and the consciousness is the totality of the physiology for all of us. And so I want you to address.
Well, can I just ask? You said you've made decisions with your gut. How would you know that you've made decisions with your gut?
I get very sick.
Uh-huh.
I actually have physical symptoms. I have massive headaches. I have all these things happen. And then when I'm released from that, when I've decided something, it's like a new person. I do not listen this much to... I get all the rational thoughts. I write them down when I'm making a decision. What do I do? What do I do? And then I listen really deeply to what the rest of my body...
So are you talking metaphorically or
no,
physically?
No.
Okay.
I think with my gut. I mean,
physically.
One of the problems I've had, I know we've got Freddie, and maybe those are Unitarians, and I'm a Unitarian too, but one of the problems I've had with that over the 50 years I've been one is that we always talk about the damn brain. We don't involve the rest of the body or the whole thing, and I find that very egomaniacal in a way. Because
what evidence do you have that thinking goes on in the gut?
To me, the same question is, does it matter? Does it matter?
Well,
your gut's making the decisions or your brain's making the decisions?
I have read that this is what the experiments are doing now. So it's not just me saying this, but this is what people are thinking, that we need to think outside of this the brain and look at the totality of how one interacts with the whole thing.
Yeah, I mean, there is a nervous system of which the brain is a part. And obviously, you know, the two are not disconnected. So, you know, the nerves in your toe actually go to your brain.
Yeah?
Yeah? I mean, you'd agree with me that, you know, you touch your toe and the impulses go to your brain. Do they, I mean, they don't go to your gut. To end up in the gut, are you saying?
No,
I'm not saying
that.
Well, there is a certain functional, there's a certain functional argument that, you know, this is how the brain works. There's no room for free will.
But what I'm saying is that yes, we are thinking with other parts of the body, so that it's not just the brain. And this is no, but this is what science is saying. I've read articles about this. Look it up.
I've read articles too, but I haven't really accepted.
Just to make light of it slightly, there's a particular species of whale that apparently has a brain that weighs a certain number of ounces, and its testicles are 7 tons. And the comment is, we don't know whether the whale has consciousness, but if it does, we know it is thinking about it. And presumably we are a totality. Like, I've got nothing wrong with the nerves being in different parts of the body. And I don't know whether you have an argument. I'm sorry, I'm not sure you did anything.
Chad.
Oh, hi, Chad. Yeah. And I don't know whether there's an argument or not. Like, it seems fairly clear that we are a totality, and I can see the where you end and all that kind of thing, sort of. And that you have different elements. Perhaps your awareness, and my awareness is the person I call I. My awareness is Fred. And other things that are part of me, I'm not aware of them. And I don't feel that they are involved in decision making. And if scientifically it can be shown that other parts of my body were aware of this decision before I, my conscious part, was, I don't know the implications to take of that. Phil, for example, was talking about the justice system. If we know, for example, that when I shoot Phil, I didn't intend it, and the decision was made before I was aware of it, and therefore I am not guilty. However, you might say, well, we don't care whether you're guilty or not, but justice has to be done, and besides, your unconscious will learn from this, and next time round, if it still persists, it won't do it, because your unconscious learned. Even if your conscious part is manipulated.
Yes, but for Henry's sake, we're going to lock you up, whether you're guilty or not. You know, because we don't want you shooting anyone else. Because obviously there's something in you that makes you a danger.
But it, will you?
I don't have to blame you for that.
Supposing you don't lock me up, you simply give me a lot of lashes, and I'm out in the street. Isn't it likely that I, my subconscious, will have learned by it, and therefore my conscious will think it has learned, even though we know it was determined to no longer be shooting people.
Well, they've been executing people for years and it doesn't work.
Oh, that's another thing.
It may or may not, the punishment has its place.
Yeah.
In altering.
It is another input.
But the point is that even if I'm not consciously making decisions at the conscious level, doesn't mean that I can't learn.
Yeah.
Oh, no, absolutely. And yet I think we often would take that. There's, well, if I'm not conscious deciding, no punishment. I don't think that's the lesson to take from it.
Yeah, depending on the questions that come to me, I may have learned that, you know, I won't do this, you know, I won't make another presentation on free will. But here you are.
I might have missed it, or but maybe not. Yes. Is there a real definition of free will that doesn't involve the words free will? I mean, is it standalone definition?
What? The word free will.
Is there a definition of free will that I can understand?
I was hoping it was going to be implied in the talk that it is really conscious control of decisions we make. I mean, so
it has to be indeterminate. It's not caused by anything.
Yes,
it has to arise from the self, not from
You can't be coerced into it with a gun in your head. Yeah.
So there are a lot of words.
Actually, Rich Burkett looked up the definition of free will in Wikipedia. Whether you like it or not, the definition wasn't Wikipedia. It was Webster.
I was just going to change the definition in Wikipedia. So.
And the definition of free will is the voluntary choice or decision I do this of my own free will kind of a thing. Freedom of humans to make decisions that are not determined by prior causes or by divine intervention. The ability to make choices that are not controlled by fate or God or gods. And the autonomy, choice, self-determination, your own volition. That kind of redundant. But the first one is the voluntary choice or decision.
Do you consider that different from the definition I just gave you?
This was longer.
Well, here's the issue, I think. Okay. The crux of the issue, from a mathematics point of view, which is my favorite, is the concept of self will always reference the concept of self. So you have a self-referential system, and in mathematics, that's extremely dangerous, because once you have a self-referential system, if you're not careful, you can have contradictions very easily. So I'm very uncomfortable with all of this talk, because it's not very precise, and it is self-referential, and once it's self-referential, you can prove anything. You can prove it exists or doesn't exist.
That's the difference between biology and math, though, isn't it?
Well, yes, but the issue is you're trying to use a deductive process to prove something doesn't exist when the deductive process, when using things that are self-referential, is unreliable.
I really don't think I'm advocating that something doesn't exist.
It sounds to me like you're saying...
I'm not advocating, I'm just... From a position of... It's a bit like atheism, right?
Right.
You know, I mean, I don't have to advocate that God doesn't exist. I don't have to prove that God exists. Right. I don't have to prove that my ego doesn't exist. You know, it is so... And like theism, it's so... it permeates everything. That you do end up trying to have to defend the argument that it doesn't exist. But really, that should just be the
default.
Yeah, the default, that it's not there. I don't have to, it's only other people that define their ego as something that exists and is separate and controls us. I don't have to, I don't really have to respond to them, because they haven't proven to me that that is the case. Sorry, I got Sandy's hand is being up for.
Well, I don't think it really is self-referential, because I mean, to me, the simplest example is if you touch something hot, there's two things going on in your nervous system. One is a nervous impulse that comes up and hits your spinal cord, knows you touched something hot and jerks your hand away. The other is an impulse that goes up into your brain and says you just ouch, that hurt, you touched something hot. We know that the ouch arrives later than the pull away. We know that, okay? But if you ask anybody, why did you just pull your hand away? They would say, I touched it, it felt hot, I pulled it away. We know scientifically that felt hot came way after, in milliseconds, but in brain terms, came way after the pull away. But your conscious mind wants to take credit. It says, I felt it, I pulled it away, okay? So, and they've done lots of experiments where they know that the unconscious mind has already decided something before you do it. Sometimes seconds before you do it. That they can tell you, I knew you were going to pull your left, it's like press the button with your left or your right hand. They can tell seconds before. So we know, it's not self-referential, we know something's going on before your conscious mind becomes aware of it, and we know the conscious mind wants desperately to take credit for it. And if you can say evolutionarily, this sense of agency that you are in charge and you are doing things is very good for your evolutionarily because it motivates you.
Why? Don't need it?
That's a good question. To me, I always think that consciousness is an accidental, like artifact of survival, and you could probably survive without consciousness at all, as many, many animals do.
And trees. And trees.
Yeah. they you just react to the environment in appropriate ways.
You didn't have to be aware of it.
Yeah. And for some reason, this consciousness has arisen, and it wants to take control, and we know that agency is very important to human beings, that babies, for instance, will, if they're pulling on something and it causes something else to move, they'll pull on it much longer than if nothing happens. You know, they love doing that. Now, why we evolved to love that, I don't know, but you can kind of see that it might have a beneficial effect. But it, so it's not self-referential. It's scientifically they see this thing is happening, and then you take credit for it.
Everything in your sentence was self-referential. From awareness to you to I, those are all self-referential terms.
I don't see it that way. I see it as...
Well, that's what they are.
You can see scientifically
define
happening.
Define I...
Afterwards, you're aware.
Define I independent of yourself. I mean, you can't do it. It's all self-referential. Everything. The whole...
But if it doesn't exist...
I'm defining action... And conscious awareness.
Okay, conscious awareness. What is that without referring to I? Without referring to consciousness? What is consciousness without referring to consciousness? There's no abstract definition. There's no other way of putting it that I'm aware of. That you can say, if you take X, Y, and Z, and you combine them this way, you get consciousness. Where X, Y, and Z aren't something like I, me, and myself.
Yeah, I don't see it that way. Like he was saying, if you stimulate the limb to move on its own, and you ask the person why'd you do that, they know that they.
But that's one small example. It's not the issue is the issue of self, the issue of consciousness is more basic than the issue of free will.
But you can define yourself
not
as
in terms
I,
of self, not
as I. I.
Okay.
Without saying I.
No, you can't.
Sure you can. Yeah. If I say I am my thoughts, then I have defined I, right? And without reference to
what are your
anything
thoughts?
Else?
What are your thoughts?
What are my thoughts?
Yes.
The my thoughts are a representation of me.
Yes. So that's about as self-referential as you get.
Well,
I mean, it just has. Anyway, I didn't want to hijack the discussion, but that's my point is, in mathematics, there was a large problem with self-referential.
Yeah, but you're the person who told us we could get two balls out of one, right?
That's right.
Yeah. So I mean, how much credence do you have?
So anyway, there's a whole area of math devoted to that problem.
Yeah.
And where they remove self-referential concepts and see what's left.
Yeah.
And it's a subset.
Are you talking about Russell paradoxes? And
that's
Gödel?
An example of a self-referential paradox.
And Gödel's theorem.
Right. Okay. Well, not Gödel's theorem, but...
Isn't that self-referential? That's a theorem about itself.
Yes, it is. But I was thinking something different.
Okay.
I've got another question.
I found your presentation really interesting, but what I'm wondering is, what do you, in the final analysis, what importance does that have to you as a human being? Because even though you may not have, I don't know what I can tell, you may not have free will, but it seems like you have free will. Don't you have to live as though you have free will?
That's an excellent point. However, we can, once we recognize it as an illusion, we can...
Where does that get you?
We increase compassion.
Compassion?
Yeah.
Don't you think people have compassion without even having...
Look at the U.S. justice system. There's no compassion in the U.S. It is basically vengeance. There's no compassion in that system. If we look at people and say, well, you know, if you were brought up as a single, you know, in a single parent household in some terrible area of Baltimore where, you know, the authorities have just abandoned you and you live on a dog-eat-dog street, you know, your upbringing, which had nothing to do with, you actually no control over, is a good predictor of your future behavior. And in looking at that, obviously you've got to take that person away from society because there's a danger. However, I'm not going to blame that person for some moral defect. You know, I don't think they were, you know, morally wrong. They were just a victim of their circumstance and their upbringing.
That's the religious contribution to corrections. If you take the religious contribution out, what you're left with is we have to remove a danger from the street, we have to provide disincentives, if we have the ability, we have to rehabilitate. But religion inserts, and you deserve pain.
Yes.
Retributive justice.
Yes.
And that's what is removed from the
and that's what you can take
you
away.
Take free will out of it.
Yeah.
And you don't have to say, and people want prison to be as hellish as possible based on that concept. You know, prison is just about losing your freedom, or it should be,
yeah.
Or maybe your dignity, or, you know.
Or just protecting society from
the
you.
The beatings and the rapes and the AIDS and all that, people just go, yes, that's what you deserve in prison, and that's a religious
yeah.
concept.
And the idea that they deserve it
yeah.
is just, yeah, to me, it's real. I wouldn't mind them living in five-star hotels. We've already taken their freedom away from them.
Yeah.
Because, you know.
But you're right.
Yeah.
I thought about this. I'm convinced that I don't have a strong free will. I'm also convinced I have to go on living as if I do.
Yes.
Right. Well, I was just wondering, while you were talking, do you believe is you know, this presentation that you gave, do you believe it's the case?
Do I believe?
Do you believe that everything that you said in your presentation, do you think that that is true?
That free will is an illusion.
That free will is an illusion.
Absolutely. I didn't used to.
I can kind of accept
I didn't
that
used
from
to.
This standpoint. And it's troubling to
okay.
I said to you, let's say that you're a person who said, I believe I have free will. And I said, okay, that means that you think by a conscious decision, you can decide to do something, you can take action. And you said yes, right? And I said, okay, stop thinking. How's that working out for you if I ask you 5 minutes later?
Absolutely impossible.
Can you stop thinking?
Absolutely impossible.
So people can't stop.
Even with meditation.
So you can't stop thinking.
Because they have no free
will. We can will whether to act or not, but we can't will what we want.
That's
we can't
right.
will what we will.
Yeah.
So
Phil, I wonder how you deal with the conundrums that are raised by that.
Like,
for example, I know we all are convinced there's no free will. Therefore, you were obliged to make that presentation saying that there was no free will. And somebody else was obliged to make a presentation refuting it. If you are obliged to do something, should we then assess it as having any truthful merit? When obviously you couldn't have said anything else simply because all of your neurons were firing in such a way that every one of those words you said was obligatory.
I could not analyze my decision accurately enough to give this presentation. But I know that I was fascinated by free will once, you know, the light went on and, you know, it disappeared. I also, you know, I for some reason, you know, I have to answer people on the internet because, you know, I find things that are wrong on the internet, so I'm compelled to write them down. You know, that's just my, you know, yeah, I mean, that's just my personality, if you like.
But if Chad Cook goes on the internet and says, Phil was wrong for all of these reasons, you can say, well, don't pay any attention to Chad. He was forced to say that.
Well, Chad said that because of who Chad is, right?
Right.
But whether he's forced to do it or not doesn't make it wrong.
No.
And
if he was forced to do it, it doesn't make it right, does it?
Of course. Phil.
There's no merit in his argument because he couldn't do anything other than
that. Well, you're using
the
term forced.
Well, your whole being pushed you in that way, so Phil says.
Well, force, it does imply there's a certain sort of, you know, external coercion.
Or predetermined.
Phil?
I purposely avoided that today. Because it's a can of worms that I'd rather leave in the can, but we can... I did mention it with the chocolate vanilla, saying if your brain state is exactly the same.
Have there been experiments to predict future brain states from existing ones?
In the experiments that they've done, you know, long after Libet, now they can... They can see.
You're taking a particular brain state and a particular model to actually go from there to predict a future brain state.
No, I don't think so. Brain state to action, but not brain state to brain state.
Oh, I see. I don't know. I'm sure there are.
That pretty much clinched the argument.
Yeah. Well, I'll say yes. Because lying is part of who I am.
Phil, here's an observation. You talked about conscious level.
Yeah.
Conscious, subconscious, but you don't mention too much about the unconscious level. Is that because they haven't done a lot of research on the unconscious level, is they can't get definite what they would say scientifically answers?
Well, I'm not sure how you would, you know, where free will comes into the unconscious, because it does imply that you are, you know, unconscious people can't really make decisions.
No, but they say you draw on the unconscious level when you get hypnotized. They go way
subconscious.
Back into the unconscious level where they don't do much. You know,
what's
like,
the distinction between subconscious and
unconscious?
I don't think there is one.
When I was at university, there was. This was 40 years ago.
Oh, we've moved on since then.
There was three levels of consciousness. Conscious, subconscious, and unconscious.
I can't give a definition for subconscious. It's different from unconscious.
I don't know.
Well, this can is unconscious, right?
Yeah.
It doesn't have a subconscious. Maybe.
No, like I think subconscious you can recall quite readily. Unconscious, you have to really be put.
But if you're unconscious, how do you respond?
Well, I don't.
You're talking about your unconscious mind, not a state of consciousness.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Unconscious mind and subconscious, to me, they're the same thing.
And what is this? You use the word self. And is the self to you just the conscious part? Or are you with Chad saying, well, the totality is the self?
What I mean by myself, it excludes my body and even my mind. My thoughts come and go. They may be different tomorrow, but it's still me. Self is independent from the theater of the mind and what all it's experiencing. It's different from all the physical. If I could be removed from my body and just float incarnate, that would still be myself. If all my ideas change tomorrow, but I still remember it was me, that's myself. Myself is the viewer.
Then I think...
Not the show.
The way they
the
talk about the... That's the conscious part. The self, I think typically, when we use the word self, we're talking only about the conscious part. Not the sub... Although you want to put it in the totality, I think the subjective feeling of self is the conscious part.
Sense of self.
Yeah, the sense
it's
of self.
And that's,
and that's how I use the word. Even if somebody says, what I really am is the totality, my sense of myself is only the conscious part.
Yeah.
And that is the one where we talk about the feelings of volition and all that.
Yes, volition has to be the conscious part.
Yeah.
But we know that drugs can dissolve your sense of self, too.
And can make and can change your ability to make a supposed free will decision. The DOPA antagonists. Drugs like Rapinerol.
The agonists, you were talking about the Parkinson drugs.
Yeah, like Rapinerol.
All the behaviors you discussed were addictions. Sex, shopping.
Binge eating.
Yeah, all addictions. And addiction and dopamine are highly tied together. And in fact, the treatment for addictions are dopamine antagonists.
Yes.
Like
well, we do attribute, sex compulsion, binge eating, stealing. We do attribute moral causes to those decisions. You know, which, when you realize you can change your morality by taking some chemical, what does that say about, the spiritual nature of morality?
Well, those addictions do define your character, but there aren't necessarily things like you say that we can blame you for or that you have control over.
Yeah. But a lot of times those things, people will say you are responsible
for your
binge eating. For
this
your
whole area
compulsion.
Is going to be as confrontational with religion as evolution was.
Yes.
Because this goes right to the heart of the core fundamental belief that you are a sinner and you are rebellious and you deserve to go to hell if you don't. Blah blah blah. If you take that away from us,
I don't agree with it.
Okay,
if you really are limiting...
What don't you agree with? Specifically, say a sentence.
You sound like a Catholic, past Catholic, or somebody who was in a born-again relationship. Religion, for me, is not that limited. It is not all about the end game and the fact that you're punished, and you've said that repeatedly. That's not defining religion as broadly...
I don't think I said that defines religion. I said it's an essential component. Of one particular
A sense of culpability, whether or not you were punished.
A sense of personal responsibility.
Yeah.
I would use the word ethical rather than religion.
What?
So,
but
he's responsible. You keep saying that it's religious, that all these factors about how we react to things when we feel like we're punished or something, that it's based upon religion. It's there are
let me say Christianity.
Yeah, okay, so that makes it clear. What I wanted to do is to respond to what you said. You asked Phil, what good does it do you to believe in neuroscience or what have you? For me, I started reading neuroscience about 3 or 4 years ago, and I've talked on the subject too. And what it's done for me is to free me up totally. And it makes me feel less culpable, less to blame for things. It's freed me from the idea of the ego, more so that I understand that we're all in this together, that there's so much we don't know. I would not limit it to just the conscious part. I think having had drug experiences myself in my youth and having transcended to other realms and then come out of it and then studied it, you know, formally in psychology and whatever, in counseling areas, I have to say that it is all a totality, and so is the physiological. And to limit it, again, to the brain, I go back to that point, I find that far too limiting and far too black and white and far too Victorian in thinking. I think we're way beyond that. This is postmodern stuff. I'm not a scientist at all, but I am really excited for me as a theologian for the last 40 years working this way. The most exciting thing for me in 40 years is neuroscience.
So where,
and I find that that's almost outside yourself? Or do you think it's
all I asked him this when he talked about it before, because it's a scary as hell thing. And it's scary to preach this. I've talked on this subject 4 or 5 times. And it's very scary to stand up before people who have this assumption, even if they're Unitarians or liberal thinkers, but they have this assumption that there's some force out there. There's some, and then you come in and say, well, I don't know, but this happens, you know, and is there something beyond that? I don't know. So that's where I go back to agnosticism rather than atheism, and I'm comfortable with that. But I'm not going to limit it just to the time.
Well, if you must add, I mean, if you had if you had some sort of blood blockage going into your gut,
yeah,
how do you think that would affect your decision making as compared to a brain blockage in your brain? And what I'm basically saying is, why do we have a brain? Because you make it sound like, well, you know, we're putting all this on the brain. Yeah, you know, we can observe more pathology in the brain relative to the way the mind works than we can relating to gut pathology and how the mind works.
What difference does it make where it's coming from in your body? Unless it's coming from outside, it makes no difference, because they used to think the heart was the thing that did the thinking.
Yeah,
it actually does
that. There's a soul somewhere.
They used to think the heart was the physical organ that did the thinking.
That's what Aristotle thought.
You know, and it's like, yeah. Well, what difference did it make? Did that change free will? Did that change moral culpability? Did that change anything? No, it was just a...
It makes no difference to the argument of free will.
It makes no difference.
But what I really like about it from a theological point of view, it just levels us. And the basic thing about Islam, about Christianity, the first sin is the sin of, that's a terrible word, I'm human, so the sin of pride. And if we can get beyond that and see, and then comes compassion for what you're saying. So I think this can bring in compassion. This is like a new spiritual movement or something. I don't see it as competing with religion or spirituality. I think it can add to it in incredible ways.
I agree with you there. I just don't see what difference it makes where it originates in your body.
I'm just saying that it's
as far as free will concerns, it doesn't
so much that it's all the synaptical thing is all kind of. Uh-huh. Like, yeah, I'm not.
What's your name?
Reverend or not? Don.
Okay, Don. Earlier you said I disagree. I'm not clear when I was speaking. I'm not clear with what I said that you disagree.
It was that retribution thing about the punishment, religion, religion.
I said it's a religious concept.
Yeah,
it comes out of the
religion. Yeah, it's not just from there. Of course, I'm just saying that that's not how I. That's not the only thing that I'm saying that religion is.
Well, me either. Like,
no, but
it's a lot more than that. But that's where that idea comes from. And when we were talking about free will, that's where religion and free will intersect. Because Christianity, anyway, absolutely depends on there being free will and a person being free to choose. And that's what justifies damnation.
But I think the religion came out of our own sense of moral culpability, not the vice versa. think the religions were able to tap into that.
We created the religion, so we
But the religion itself taps into that, just like they're more ancient.
But that bond that actually changes what sustains it in Western culture.
Yeah,
but
because it taps into something basic.
Without disagreeing too directly, we're talking about religion as if we created it. Failing to recognize that there is nothing that we haven't created. The Bible is pure fiction, pure lie. Islam is. Cash is a lie. We made it up. Country is a lie. We have to, in this world, in order to operate, we have to make up stories, and we have to try to persuade people to buy our stories, even though none of them, the only thing that exists, perhaps, is suffering. But everything else is fiction. We can criticize religion, but there's nothing as a story that isn't legitimately criticizable. And the only thing is that we get together and we try to make sure other people believe our stories, because the fantastic thing about our species is that it's through stories that we start cooperating. And we get enough people believing this story, we can do amazing things. Don't get into the thing of saying, is it true or not? Get into the thing of saying, how powerful is that?
But not all fiction.
We do something with it.
Not all fictions are equal.
But
all fictions are false. All fictions are made up. There's none of them are true. Some are more useful than others.
Yeah.
But they tap into our base, what's already there in us. And the more you can tap into, like our personal sense of culpability or our personal sense of agency or all those things that exist, the better
it is. But those are stories. Human rights is a story. It's made up. But we can't live without a story.
Well, you seem to be using the word story and lie synonymously with abstraction.
Well, sure, but we are an imaginative species. And that imagination is at the center of our history over the last thousands of years. And it's why we dominate this planet and screw it.
The story is the thing that taps into your basic, the story is, if you're poor, it's your fault. It's because you weren't a good enough person. That's a story.
That's a story.
And the more you can persuade people of that story, it changes the way we do things.
Part of this, right?
Our thinking is fallible, right? I mean, that's why we have science, right?
And our
the scientific matter.
Our thinking is fun.
But it's fallible.
It's how we have to live.
I mean, as Henry will point out.
That's what our thinking is correct. And that's whether our expectations result in, whether our actions based upon our beliefs result in outcomes that we preferred and expected. If we have an idea, if we have idea I, that action A will lead to result R, if it does that consistently, then that idea was good and useful.
Yeah.
And
but
if it doesn't, then it's not.
Our problem right now is that our world is without a good story. We have this story about globalism, about everything working together, and liberal notions, and now, as we've seen in Brexit and Trump and all that, half of the world no longer buys that story. And we no longer have a story that we can all feel good about. And we need to generate it.
But it comes back, that action A equals result R, you can persuade different people believe action A results in R1 and R2, R3, R4.
I do the same thing and get different outcomes?
No, just the idea of, like,
the interpretation?
Interpretation
of the result?
You can convince people that a certain action, like trickle-down economics. Trickle-down economics will result in a better economy. And you can demonstrate over and over, it didn't happen.
Yeah.
These people still have that story in their head. Until you can jar that story, you are sunk. That's why Trump won. He was a great teller.
The same thing we're talking about. We're talking about our correct ideas, and I'm defining correct by their utility. If the idea works, it's correct.
But I'm saying that people believe in trickle-down economics. They believe it has utility. Even if it doesn't.
Those people are wrong.
The story is what, in the human brain, the story is what matters.
Yeah.
And you've got to draw the story. That's why Trump wants to see the best story.
I'm not disagreeing with that. I'm saying something different right beside it.
Okay.
The distinction between good ideas and bad ideas is what you can do with
it. Yeah, I completely buy that.
Yeah.
And that's what the scientific, for Gary's sake, that's what the scientific is talking about. It's trying to move the method to really establish what's the R of it.
Yeah. I get this all the time because I spend a lot of time on the internet. Prove that evolution occurred,
prove that there's not creation. I said, I don't have to. I said, my idea, evolution, unifies a mountain range full of ideas. It makes predictions about what can and cannot be found in nature that have never been contradicted. And it has a useful application. We can do horticulture. We can do medicine. We can provide, we can do all kinds of things with it. Your idea does none of those things.
Yes.
Your idea explains nothing, predicts nothing, and is useless.
I say to 45% of people in the United States still believe that,
tell it like it is.
That evolution never happened because it's because their story resonates better with them. Then you're still not going to be able to move
ahead. No, it's a great point. I don't know why we keep going back to that. I can see that. People make mistakes. People are wrong. People don't think.
I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm just saying there's a corollary that's important. And to me, that's the whole idea behind this. Do we have free will or not? You know, what story resonates with us?
Yeah. Thank you.
What time is it?
5:30.
Okay. I guess that's. Are we done? Is there more coming
in? I have a couple of points. One, we need to get emails of those new people who would like to keep up with notifications of our activities. And the other thing is, we might get backlash from this sometime in the future, Stephen, but the 80 peso agreement we have with the...
Are we not spending that?
Probably not. I haven't yet.
Now we continue on. We stay here till about 8.
Oh well,
here's the problem. So I don't want to put the 80 pesos in the newspaper, and the people that are here new haven't heard that.
Right.
Don't know that. They come here not knowing that we're expected to spend 80 pesos a piece. Maybe I should announce that at the beginning. But that's the deal we made with the entrepreneur and restaurateur to use this room. And we'll all spend 80 pesos. We can use this room, and no extra charge. So I put that in an email that goes out to Lakeside Freethinkers, but not into the paper.
Right. And I want to add that I've eaten outside before, and they kind of don't count that. That's like
they don't count that.
I know.
Oh, really?
It's kind of like you're a new.
Well, you wouldn't be here eating outside if it wasn't for the meeting.
Well,
explain it to them in Spanish.
50 pesos that order something I don't want to eat. That I'm,
you know,
I'm, is
that your
grant?
That I, yeah, that
okay,
I spent,
you're pretty close.
Yeah.
It only takes two glasses of wine.
I don't want to step something down just because I have to spend 80.
Yeah,
I'd
so is it the totality, 80 pesos
per person?
Excuse me. But I don't know if I just spent 200.
Did you just spend 200?
Yeah, and so
okay.
Can I give some to you?
I would say you can. All you have to do is count up the total and get 80 times the number of heads. They don't have to come 80 per person.
Thank you.
And I'm well over the 82, so I think we probably covered the that.
Email addresses.
We
like new members.
No, I'm assuming Chad has my email, even if you can't contact me with it.
Yeah, the reason you don't get email, Brad, is another issue completely.
I don't know, but I understand how I cannot communicate with Fred by email.
Yeah.
Whenever I do, it's dead air.
So if you say religion, you're not allowed to say religion here, right?
Sure you are.
I was here once before.
Sure you are.
2 years ago.
I hope I didn't seem hostile to you.
I'm joking. I've had worse.
I am anti-theistic, but I'm not anti-theist. I don't consider believers to be the problem. You know, it's the abstraction, or as Fred calls it, the lie.
That's my objective.
But for every lie, there's a liar.
Well, I don't consider it a lie. I consider it just a wrong idea.
Well, I know I call the Bible a lie.
Oh. Okay.
But I also call cash a lie.
I think it was an initial attempt to explain
our world and our lives. It wasn't a bad idea in its day. I'm pretty sure that if I had lived... before, say, the time of, say, the Middle Ages, I would have been a theist. What else are you going to say about all this?
Oh, yeah.
So it's not, it wasn't...
Well, until Darwin and them came along, you had to think that a watch requires a watchmaker.
I agree.
Yeah.
I think by the time of Darwin, I would have been a deist, right before Darwin. Because, you know, the first wave of scientists were the Galileos and Newtons and Avogadros and Volta, you know, who's going to talk about. They explained how the world operates and showed us that it could operate without a ruler, as a clockwork. So we didn't really need a God in the universe anymore. He could have made the universe and stepped out, hence deism. But
there was no explaining why it was here. We still needed a creator god, even if we didn't need a ruler god. But then we discovered how the universe can organize itself without a builder. And so between Darwin and Hubble, we didn't need the builder god either. We still have origins problems. We don't know where the singularity came from, and we don't know where the first cell came from. So that's a last...
So can you be a neuroscientist and a theist of any kind?
Of course.
You sure are.
And lots are.
Not a good neuroscientist.
good itself is a made-up story.
Between Francis Collins and Sam Harris.
I know Sam.
Yeah, you know, Francis Collins is head of the NIH. And he's a Christian. He's not
I have heard of this, yes.
So who's the Christian?
Francis Collins, the NIH. And Sam Harris says, who's going to fund my research looking for the source of morals and behavior when the guys making the decision thinks it comes from the sky?
Right.
That assumes he's biased in that regard, and he might or might not be. I don't happen to. I think that's an empirical question.
How can you not be?
No. It's not a logical question. It's an empirical one.
Where are you going?
Well, I mean, you have to get rid of every single Christian idea to be on the same level with Harris. As soon as you bring faith-based ideas into it, your thinking is a little different.
And there's a consequence to that, as he points out.
Yeah.
You know.
Like, for example, the Christians who tell me that they believe in evolution, I say they don't believe in the same evolution I do.
Mm-hmm.
Because my evolution is undirected. My evolution is blind. It didn't intend for human beings to exist on Earth, and it didn't put a soul in them either. And if you think that there's a God in whose image we were created, and with whom, to whom we are special, but you think that somehow we evolved, and you think that God pushed us in that direction, that's not Darwinian evolution at all. That's theistic evolution.
There are different definitions of humanism, too.
Where are the secular and non-secular?
Right. Or scientific humanism, Buddhist humanism. I mean, one of the things I wanted to say was that, again, when I heard you before, this was throughout your talk for me, it sounded so Buddhistic. It sounded so much like Buddha. The world is an illusion and all these things. And yet you do good. It's not a religion per se, but it's an ethical imperative to do good. And realizing that you're not ultimately in control. That's Buddhism.
I think doing good benefits the most people. Right?
Yeah.
So, you know, I have no problem with that.
What about my dog?
That benefit, you know, accruing as part of evolution. Why not?
Yeah.
You know, we're social animals. I think we operate better when there is some degree of trust. And I think trust has evolved.
Cooperation is mutually beneficial to us all. We all do better, like you said.
Yeah.
That's how it evolved. That's why morality evolved.
Yeah.
It was skillful and unskillful. And ethically, behaving ethically is a more skillful way to behave because it's going to work better.
It profits us individually. It profits everybody, but it profits us. It's win-win. If I behave ethically to you, I win and you win.
And there are unethical people who operate. But a species can only tolerate a certain number of unethical people.
And I think we're researching.
Are you sure about that? Yeah. Sandy, you were saying, right? But you were saying that the number of, Sandy? The number of unethical people that a society can tolerate?
Well, the study was on opportunism. It was actually fish. Okay, so the idea behind opportunism is there's altruism and there's opportunism. The altruism says everybody's cooperating. Now the opportunists can take advantage of the cooperation by seizing things, right? But they found in this fish society, when that became more than, I think it was about 10% of the population, then they started dying out because others...
There wasn't enough people to take advantage of.
Yeah, they lost enough cooperation that... They couldn't take advantage anymore, and they would go back to 10%.
So the steady state is 10%.
About that.
I'm just
and that's
people.
Why the opportunists can't take over, because then everybody would die out.
Yeah. So there's two of us in here that we don't trust.
That's cooperative.
Have you heard of the prisoner dilemma?
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's similar to that. Exactly. Yeah.
engage
with. So would you consider doing a talk on consciousness? Because I think that's a precursor to free will. So
it is, isn't it? But it
are
is
we done?
Difficult.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay.
We make the email thing that we go on to whoever wants to.
Okay, wait a minute. Nobody can leave until I say this. Meeting adjourned.
All right.